You're listening to Fuck Wellness, where we say fuck you to the wellness industry by building a definition of wellness that aligns with what you actually need.
Join hosts Laura, Mallory, and McKenna every Wednesday, where we try and figure out what the hell is going on in the wellness industry by talking to people who understand wellness or are just as lost as we are.
We are so excited that you're here. Don't forget to rate and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Generation 3 Girls. Now, let's go to the show. Ryan, can you get me some water?
Do I get to say hi to Ryan?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Never met Ryan.
Oh, that is so weird. Ryan, can you come fill up my cup?
What a great, nice boyfriend.
He's the sweetest boy in the whole world.
Oh my God, I love that for
you. Hi, do you want to meet Sarah?
Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Hi.
It's so nice to meet you. I see your picture all the time in social media, and I hear lovely things about you from Mallory.
Well, I hear lovely things about you. Mal talks about you all the time. You're like the coolest
person
in the world, according to her.
She's my favorite, so you make sure you take good care of her.
I think I do.
I hear you're doing that. So
get your water. Yeah, right,
don't worry.
I just need that as soon as possible. Thank you. Yeah, he's a very sweet angel, and
I love that.
I'm a big fan of him. Yeah, we have our 2.5 year anniversary in less than a month.
Has it been that long already?
Yeah, I know. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fuck Wellness. I'm Mallory, and I'm actually by myself today because I have the privilege of bringing on someone that we've talked about now 3 times on the podcast, and I've coerced her into coming. Just kidding. She's voluntarily here. In our first episode, Virginity is a Scam, I talked about how my human sexuality professor from college was maybe the most impactful professor I've ever had and how she was very influential in leading me to get my master's degree in public health, and especially looking deeper at sexual and reproductive health. And it turns out I'm not alone, that lots of other people have been influenced by her. And I had Zach and Carrie, 2 of my friends from the Capital Peers, on for our 3rd sexuality podcast. And they both mentioned how influential she has been in their life. So I'm super excited to have Sarah Asselson here, all of our favorite human sexuality professors. So thanks for being on the podcast, Sarah.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. Don't make me cry saying nice things.
I honestly feel like we're going to get so many DMs from people being like, oh my gosh, she was my professor too. You're a legend.
Oh my gosh. I love that. Well, I'm just lucky I get to do it every day, and I'm so grateful. It's just such an awesome job, and I can't believe they pay me to do it. It's kind of crazy.
It is. So I guess going into that, tell us a little bit about yourself. Give a little bit of a background on you.
Absolutely. So I've been working in sexual and reproductive health for over 15 years now. I actually got a master's degree in social work, not public health, because I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And then I started working in sexual health after that. And I cannot imagine doing anything differently with my life. It is the best field to be in with the most amazing people. And I'm so incredibly lucky that this is what I get to do for my job every day. I work full-time for a national reproductive health organization, and then I teach part-time, and I've been doing that for 10 years this semester, which is pretty crazy when you think about it. So
think about how many students that is.
You know, I tried to like add it up one time and put it all together in a letter that I was writing or something for the school, and it was really nuts to think about like that number of folks and, you know, hundreds of students every year times 10 years is like really crazy.
Wow. This episode is going to be a bit different because we have solicited questions from our audience, as well as some, I guess, hot topics or hot questions that people have that Sarah is going to answer on this podcast. So do you want to talk a little bit about the Ask It Basket? And I can give a little bit of background on where this idea came from.
Totally. So in my class, one of the things that I do every single semester is the Ask It Basket. And so at the end of every class session, students have to put, they write an anonymous question and they put it into the Ask It Basket about anything that they want to know. And if they don't have a question, they can write no question, or they can write a little note to me, but everybody has to put something in the basket so that you know that everyone is contributing in some way. And it's one of the students' favorite things in my class. And in particular, I do it because I feel like there are a lot of things that people are really scared to ask verbally or to share publicly in a setting like that because of all of the shame and stigma around sexuality. And so I really just want to create a safe space where students can ask the things they want to know and then get them answered at the beginning of class the very next week.
Do you remember the question I asked?
Oh, I'm sure you asked a bunch of questions. I don't know that I remember them all.
You told me at the time it was one of your favorites. No, I'm not offended. You don't remember. I asked if semen counts as an animal product.
That is one of my favorites. I think that usually comes up as like one of the best ones I've ever gotten because usually people want to know like, what's the weirdest question you've ever had? Or what's the most memorable question? That's one I recount frequently.
So I'm a legend too, in a small way, also in your class.
Obviously, completely. I think I talk about you every semester too, as like, this is what you can do with your life. You can go on to get a master's, an MPH, and you can have a podcast and you can talk about healthy sexuality. So yes, totally a legend.
Today we are going to go through some questions and Sarah's going to answer them. So a question that we got frequently was about different types of sexuality. So there was a question about how do I know if I'm polyamorous? How do I know if I'm asexual or just not interested in sex? How do I know if I'm bisexual? So I was wondering if you could break down those terms a little bit and then talk a little bit about how people can identify as those.
Yeah, absolutely. So the sort of overarching thing that I would say about this is that figuring out who you are and who you're, you know, how you identify in terms of your sexuality is a process. And it can take a different amount of time for different people. And for some people, it's really easy. And for some people, it's more complicated. And all of those things are totally normal and okay. So that's like message number one, right? If you are figuring that out for yourself, that's awesome. You're on a journey and absolutely like give yourself grace and kindness as you figure that out. In terms of some of the specific identities that they talked about, asexuality is one that comes up frequently. I've actually seen a lot more students talking about that in recent years. And generally speaking, people, there's actually about 1% of people in the world who are asexual, which if you take that out of like the world population is 75 million people. So it's really common in terms of that particular identity. And oftentimes what we talk about with people trying to figure out if they're asexual or not is just how they feel about sexual relationships and sexual encounters with other people. Someone who is asexual doesn't have any kind of sexual attraction or doesn't desire any kind of sexual contact with other people. Sometimes they'll use the term ace, which is like a shorthand term to describe themselves. And it's really important to note that people who are asexual can be straight, they can be queer, they can be bi, they can have any other kind of sexual orientation, but just not specifically have that desire to engage in sexual activity. And so when people are trying to figure this out for themselves, sometimes we tell them to think through some common questions about like, you know, if you, have you ever been sexually attracted to another person? How did you experience that feeling? If you want to date or potentially have a long-term relationship in the future, potentially marry someone, do you want sexual activity to be part of that? Do you want to engage in sexual practices with other people? And so thinking through some of these questions about how you envision your future, whether or not you see that as part of your relationship, can be something that helps people sort of process, do I identify in this way or do I not? The same thing is true of bisexuality, right? Like, how do I feel about people with this particular gender identity? How do I feel about people with that particular gender identity? Who do I experience sexual attraction to? And starting to figure out what that looks like. And I think with bisexuality, like one of the things that I see most often is people think that it means that you like equally like this, the same amount of people who identify as male and the same amount of people who identify as female, right? It's like this 50-50 split. And that is just not what bisexuality is. And so I would say that, you know, it doesn't mean that you're like most of the time interested. Bisexuality can be like most of the time you're interested in this person or some of the time you're interested in this person, but just that you find people of those different identities attractive. So I think it's really important to just clarify again that this takes a long time to figure out for some people, and that is totally okay.
You get to pick the labels that you identify as. It's like if you mostly like men, but you like a few women. If you identify as bisexual, that is valid and that is your decision. But if you choose not to use that label, that's also totally valid in your decision. So I think a lot with those labels, it's about what feels right to you and not feeling like you have to take on a label because that's what society is telling you to do.
100%. Nobody else should be defining your sexual orientation, your sexual identity for you. You should be defining that for yourself based on how you feel. And then you should be deciding how you want to talk about that. And, you know, I feel like, especially lately, people don't even want to put any label on it. They just want to exist and be who they are and love who they love. And that's wonderful and great. And I hope that we can all just learn to celebrate that.
I love that. So this next question goes a little bit more into communicating in a partnership. So the question is, how do I ask a guy to go down on me? And I know that's probably something that a lot of people wonder, but we do talk a lot about how communication is key to relationships. So how would you advise someone to start that conversation?
All right. So I think with this particular question, it's exactly what you said, Mallory. It's all about communication. I don't know the specific circumstances for this person. And I don't know that it's whether it's something they've tried before and it didn't go well, or they haven't ever tried and they want to try. And so I think it's just really important to be able to articulate what it is you want for your partner and to be able to say and ask clearly for what you'd like from them. I also will always encourage people to use positive reinforcement as a great way of communicating with your partner about what you like and what works for you. Everybody responds well to hearing, like, when they're doing something well, or when they're making their partner feel good, or when they're making their partner happy. And so I think if you can share that with them and say what's working for you, either in the moment or after the moment, then that's a really good sort of reward system too.
And I found too that starting those conversations early on in a relationship can be really helpful, rather than waiting for you to build up like resentment or disappointment, not waiting for things to blow up, because that can often end up with neither party very happy with the situation.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, we talk about using kind of a, you know, a model of communication that is based on assertive communication and being able to state clearly, you know, a fact or a feeling about how you're feeling, and be able to ask for what it is that you want, and then be able to communicate with your partner about their response and how they feel about that. And so I think, to your point, like, start that practice early with your partner of being able to say, hey, I really like this, or hey, I'd love to try that, or I'm interested in this. I think that becomes one of the most difficult things for people to do. And like you said, the earlier that you can build that sort of rapport with your partner, the better, or partners.
So this goes along with our communication conversation, but what is the best way to bring up and talk about faking an orgasm with your now long-term partner?
Yeah, this is such a tough question, because I feel like people just, you know, nobody wants to feel bad about how they engage with their partner and whether or not they're pleasing their partner and making their partner feel good. I've never found someone who wants anything other than to make their partner feel happy and to make them feel pleasure and to have a great sexual relationship with them, if that's what they're both interested in. So generally speaking, my best advice is to focus on how you start to change that moving forward, right? So maybe you're not seeking out an opportunity to tell them, hey, this has never gone right for me, or this has never worked for me, I've always been faking it. But maybe you start to communicate more assertively about, like, hey, I'm not quite there yet, or this didn't work for me this time, could we do it a little bit differently next time? Or, hey, I really love this thing from you, can you maybe do more of that? And I think generally partners, again, like going back to that positive feedback, right? Like, partners will be responsive to knowing what makes someone feel good. And so my hope is that perhaps steering the conversation that direction is a bit more productive in terms of starting to change future behavior. And I would say, be honest with your partner. Like, if it's okay, if you feel safe doing so, right? If you feel safe communicating that you didn't have an orgasm, then share that. It's important for them to know that and to know what works for your body and what doesn't.
And I think especially key here too is learning about yourself and what you like can be really useful in these conversations, because if you have to like learn while you're also doing it, that can be challenging. And so I know what's really helped me is starting that exploration early and then kind of getting to explore by myself, but also with my partner. And I feel like that's the perfect recipe for sort of collaboration and honesty, but also some like self-knowledge of what you need from the situation too. So that can be a helpful tool, because oftentimes then the partner will be like, okay, so what do you need then? And if you're like, I don't know. I have no idea. Then, you know, that's not bad, but that means maybe that will trigger some self-expression and exploration in yourself.
Yeah, we talk about that all the time. And generally speaking, right, it's really hard for you to communicate what you like if you don't know yourself. So we do a lot of work to bust some of the myths that exist around masturbation and around figuring out what works for your body. And we try to make people more comfortable with knowing how they feel and then being able to talk about that with another person, which when you're first getting into those relationships can be really, really tough and awkward and uncomfortable. And so the more you can be familiar with that yourself, then the easier it'll get to share it with someone else.
Totally. All right. Next up. Am I the only one who is always paranoid about being pregnant, even when I'm on birth control and use condoms?
No, you are not. This is so common. And I think a lot of people feel that way, right? And I don't know that it's a function of a particular reason or a thing that makes us feel that way. I think that people who have a uterus have been taught to see periods and menstruation as like the only reason that they have that is to indicate that they're not pregnant. So you get like hyper focused on pregnancy, right? If you're engaging in sexual activity with a partner who could cause a pregnancy. And so I think that this is totally normal. And the media like highlights the stories of when things go wrong, right? They don't highlight all the times when like birth control works great and people don't get pregnant. That's not the news story. And so I think that we learn to like be paranoid about these kinds of things in part because of the media we consume and then in part because of the messages that we get about our bodies and how they function and what they're doing.
I talked on the last podcast about how when I was younger, I wasn't allowed to watch The Secret Life of the American Teenager. And I always thought about how my takeaway from not being able to watch it was that the worst thing you could do was be a pregnant teenager and that's what I should be fearful of above all. So yeah, I think a lot of unlearning has had to happen since then to know that, A, that's not something necessarily to live in fear of. There are ways that you could educate yourself and tools that you can use to making sure that you're living in the way that you personally would like to live. So,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we always highlight for people like when a pregnancy does happen, there are choices that people can make. And so I feel like, you know, again, it's just that learning and perspective of thinking about our bodies and about what they can do and what we're taught to pay attention to.
All right. This ties into our next question, which is how common is abortion?
Abortion is super common. 1 in 4 women in the US will have an abortion by the age of 45. So chances are statistically, you probably actually know someone who has had an abortion. And people just don't talk about it because of the stigma and the shame that exists around it. But having an abortion is a totally viable and appropriate option for people who find themselves in that situation and want to access that kind of legal medical care. So absolutely incredibly common. And I hope that we can do more work to like open up the conversation around that and to be able to talk about just how common this is for so, so many people.
If someone is pregnant and wants to learn about all their different options, do you know any resources, the best resources to look into that?
Yeah, there's tons of options. So there's great information on bedsider.org. There they have a clinic locator as well as a resource called Abortion Finder, which has over 750 verified abortion providers in the United States. Great way to make sure that you're finding a reputable clinic where providers can talk to you about all of the different options that you have. So I would absolutely direct people to that resource. I think it's a great way to make sure that, again, you are going to a clinic that will give you all of the information that you deserve and should have access to.
All right, let's see. Next up we have, do you still have to use a condom if you and your partner are monogamous?
This is a great question. And it's actually one of the things I do in class to see, like, how do people feel about this? Do they agree or disagree in this like values activity exercise? And it's usually pretty split. Some people feel like, yeah, you should always use one. And some people feel like, well, you have a monogamous partner. And so that's where you are. Ultimately, what I say about this is that it's your decision and you get to decide the level of risk that you are willing to take on. Generally speaking, a condom is going to reduce any risk of STIs. There are STIs that have window periods that may not show up immediately as positive on a test. And so it's really important to understand there is a level of risk if you're choosing to have sex with a partner, even a monogamous partner, without a condom. But again, you know, that's the level of risk that you get to choose. The best practice and the safest thing to do is to always use a latex barrier method.
How many times can you take emergency contraception before it messes with your fertility?
Oh my gosh, this question is so important to me. And the answer is as many times as you want. There is no evidence that taking emergency contraception a certain number of times has any impact on your fertility. And here we're talking about oral emergency contraception. So pills like Plan B, My Way, Next Step, Take Action, et cetera, or Ella for that matter as well. Because as a side note, you can also get an IUD as a form of emergency contraception, both a copper IUD and brand new research as of January, a hormonal IUD as well. So anyways, going back to the point here, you can take emergency contraception as many times as you need to, and there's no evidence that it will mess with your fertility. But the point is that emergency contraception can be really expensive, right? It can be $40, $50 every time you have to buy it, sometimes $17 on Amazon. So make sure you check that out too. But I want to recommend that there are cheaper options out there, right? And so while it's fine for your body and it won't have any impact on your fertility long-term, according to the evidence, we can probably also help you find a more affordable method of contraception that you could use long-term, particularly with the Affordable Care Act and most methods of contraception being covered. So I would recommend, if you can, to get in and see a provider and assess whether or not there's something else that you could take that might be a more affordable option for you.
All right. Next up, can you still get an STI with a condom?
Yes, in fact, you can. And that's part of why we talk about it's your decision how much risk you want to take on. There are STIs that are transmitted through skin-to-skin contact. And even when no symptoms are present. And so it's important to understand that that can always be the case, even if you are using a condom. Also, just want to touch here on the fact that lots and lots of people choose to have oral sex without any kind of latex barriers, thinking that that won't present any risk. And there are STIs that you can also get through unprotected oral sex. So really important, again, the safest and most effective way to prevent transmission is by using a latex barrier.
This may be TMI, but after your class was the first time I tried a dental dam. So
love that. Yeah, we share them in the contraceptive options class and lots of people have never seen them before. They come in all sorts of flavors, mint, banana, grape. So definitely recommend those for that kind of activity. Great.
Yeah, it was a generally positive experience. I also tried internal condoms at one point. Did not love those as much. It felt like I had a plastic bag inside of me, but
it's different for everybody. Yeah. Some people really like them. Some people don't. And that's the awesome thing about contraception, right? Is you can try different options until you find what works for you. And there's so many methods out there that absolutely I would encourage. Like if the first one isn't it, right? If internal condoms isn't it, try something else and see how that goes.
I do really like the part of internal condoms where it feels empowering that I get the control of it rather than relying on a partner. So I feel like I really did like that part of it.
Yeah, that's great. And most internal condoms are made out of polyurethane. And so for a lot of people who have a latex allergy, internal condoms can be a great option as well.
Fun facts of the day.
There you go.
Okay. Do you still have to go to the gynecologist if you've never been sexually active? If so, at what age is a good time to start? Oh, I love this question.
This is a great question. So the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists recommends that people start going to see a gynecologist at the age of around 13 years old. But let me be clear that that is not because you like automatically need a pap smear at 13. It's actually so that you can just start a relationship with a provider and you can get comfortable seeing that person, talking to them about sexual health related topics and things that might feel uncomfortable or awkward at first. So if that's possible, that's a great age for people to start. But I would say that the second best age is as soon as you can. If you haven't been before and you're 18, 20, 22, it's okay. And the next step is figuring out where the best provider is for you to try and go in for a visit now. And it's never too late to go. It's always great to get started as soon as you can.
I feel like this next one is a kind of loaded question, but who's hornier, guys or girls?
Oh my gosh, so loaded. I have a lot of feelings about this question. Because first of all, those are not the only gender identities that exist, right? Let's talk about the fact that there's all different kinds of people with all different gender identities, all different bodies, all different parts, and all of that is normal and healthy and wonderful. And your sex drive is not a function of what your biological sex is. So I think there's a lot of, again, thanks to society and all the messages that the media gives us, there's a lot of misperceptions about this particular topic. And the fact of the matter is that people's sex drive is so individualized. It's not based on their sex or their gender identity. It's also so deeply related to everything else that's going on in someone's life, right? Do they feel safe and comfortable with their partner? Are they taking medication? Are they stressed out because they're going to school and working two jobs or whatever that looks like? So this not only changes for every individual all the time, but also just is not a blanket thing that is related to your biological sex.
Dare I say the biopsychosocial model really plays in here?
I would absolutely support that statement. Yes.
I feel like such a nerd.
I love it.
I love that. I also just feel like the term horny is a really loaded term too. I feel like there's a lot that goes along with that.
Yeah, I agree. I just think like sex drive in general and people's libido is, it's so personalized. And I was in this workshop one time where we split into groups based on like, are you the person in your relationship who has a stronger sex drive, or are you the person in your relationship who has a less strong sex drive? And it was such an interesting conversation to hear with and talk with people within your group about what they were worried about their partner thinking about their experience, and then like what the people in the other group actually felt about it. There's so many beliefs about like, okay, if you have less sex drive in your relationship, then like you're gonna, you know, your partner's gonna need to go like find someone else, or they're gonna be unhappy with you. And the people in the other group were worried that they were like putting pressure or a burden on people with less sex drive who didn't necessarily want to do that all the time. So I feel like there's so much miscommunication about it. And I wish that people could talk more about the fact that this just depends on who you are. And sometimes even on like the day of the week or like the time of the day. And it's just a place to have a conversation as opposed to thinking that like everyone's always going to be the same.
And I do feel like there are, as you kind of answered with that there's not two genders, I also feel like there are so many norms around that, like assuming that men will always have a higher sex drive. And I have female friends who would say that they have a higher sex drive, and that has really brought them a lot of shame. Like they feel like there's something wrong with them. And I think you're so right that it has to be like, it's a dynamic thing.
Yes.
It's not going to be static forever.
Yeah. And I hope that like your friends and anyone who feels that way learns that that is totally okay, that that's their experience, and learns to celebrate it and talk about it with their partner and figure out what works for both of them together in like a healthy, consensual way.
All right. This next one is a hot one, maybe hot in more ways than one. What's a G-spot?
Oh, great question. So a G-spot is a spot on the anterior wall of the vaginal canal. So if a person with a vagina is laying on their back, it's like the wall that faces up towards their stomach. And it's between what the sort of back of their pubic bone and their cervix. So usually about an inch in, people will describe it as a raised area, like about the size of a dime. But all of that being said, here's the things you need to know about the G-spot. So there is super mixed research about the G-spot in terms of sex researchers and opinions in this field. Lots of people who self-report having a G-spot will also self-report experiencing female ejaculation, which is often referred to as squirting, more frequently. And so if you have a G-spot, then you may be more likely to experience female ejaculation. But not everybody has a G-spot. We don't actually know if the G-spot is a real thing in that sense. And it is totally normal to have that, do that, or not have that and not do that. And so anyone who has any experiences around this, please do not feel like if you have one, you're normal, or if you don't have one, you're not normal. That's not the case. The G-spot is just a place where some people experience reporting more pleasure, And pleasure is different for everybody. So if that particular area doesn't do it for you, there's probably other places that do, and that is totally okay and healthy and normal.
That's a great answer. 10 out of 10. All right, we have two questions left. This next one is a curveball. I'm a vegetarian. Should I eat semen? If I'm a vegetarian, is it an animal product? The world wants to know.
Oh my gosh, I don't even remember how I answered this question for you. I mean, generally speaking, semen is a mixture of like water and salt and sucrose. And I mean, how did I even answer this for you when we talked about this?
I want the audience to know that I caught her off guard and she was not expecting this question. So,
I mean, at the most basic level, it is like a combination of water and salt and sugars, basically. So depending on how you think about semen within sperm, I feel like there's some level of individualized take on that particular answer.
Well, my argument would be, if we're considering honey an animal product, then I definitely feel like semen is an animal product.
I mean, there is an argument that it is vegan, appropriate for people if they are vegan and want to consume it. I think the argument in favor of that from those people who believe that is that, well, sperm are alive in a very crude biological sense. They're not conscious or sentient in any way. And so that makes the distinction. But again, I feel like this is kind of a case-by-case basis thing on like, where do you fall on the semen vegan question? And I think you're allowed to decide for yourself what that means.
I would personally love audience responses to this question. So please flood us with your answers to this question. I'm super curious. Thank you for taking that one. The last one is planned. Don't worry.
Oh, just FYI, I did also do a quick Google. And just in case you were wondering, the Vegan Society does take a strictly neutral position on the actions of consenting adults. So
no backbone.
Not weighing in on the vegan sperm question.
Wow. I feel like it's going to be a hot topic for the rest of time.
Oh, yeah. We obviously need to know where folks stand. Please weigh in and tell us.
I think it should be a presidential question, honestly. Ask the candidates, see where they stand.
That would make my day.
I would love to watch that. All right. Our final question is, what are the best resources to start looking into your sexuality?
Yeah, this question is a good one, but it's kind of vague. And I sort of feel like the answer is it depends. Mm-hmm. It depends a lot on what aspects of your sexuality you want to look into, right? There's tons of amazing organizations out there that do really phenomenal work on this topic. I will always, always recommend that folks go take a look at Bedsider if they aren't familiar with it already. Bedsider.org is a phenomenal resource for folks like 18 to 29 who are looking for information on sexual health, methods of contraception, etc. Several other national nonprofit organizations, Advocates for Youth, puts out some great resources around, I think I might be bisexual, or I think I might be asexual, or I think I might be gay. And so those are some great tools and resources that you can check out too. And then there's other like anonymous question forums. There's organizations like Scarlatine and Go Ask Alice. So it really, really, really depends on what it is that you want to look for and learn more about.
For our audience listening, what do you wish they knew about sexuality? Or what is one piece of advice you have for them to take away from this episode?
This is such a good question. And I think what I would say is that, you know, again, like sexuality is complex and it's such an integral part of who we are as humans. And yet we pretend or we sort of put out a message in society that we shouldn't be able to talk about it. And I think that the more people can engage in these discussions, can talk and get more comfortable discussing sexuality and who they are and how they show up to the table, I think the better and healthier our society will be as a whole. So I would say to everyone that whatever questions you have, someone else probably has them too. And so it's great to get them answered, but also to be willing to discuss it and to help other people get comfortable talking about these topics. It's super important for all of our health and well-being and just a great step that we can all take as we grow. It's really good for our health and well-being.
Will you be teaching human sexuality in the fall?
Oh my gosh. Yes. We haven't formalized the fall schedule yet, but generally speaking, I've taught at least one section every semester since 2011. So definitely check it out. If you want to sign up, we'd love to have you in class. We'll do lots more Ask a Basket. You can try to stump me with questions based on what we talked about today, but certainly would love to have more students and sign up early because it usually closes the first day.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much. This has been an absolute blast and I feel super lucky to have had you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so proud of you and so proud of all of the students that have been part of this series this month. I was listening and just like blown away by all of the amazing work that you all are doing. And, you know, I say all the time to my students, like, it's not me that makes class great. It's all of you and everything that you bring and everything that you share. And I feel very strongly that that is and always will be the case. So I'm so appreciative of you having me on and giving me a chance to chat about all the stuff that I love talking about.
Yay. Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.